I saw you a year ago doing the Ligeti with Symphony in C across the river in Camden. Now you're doing this incredibly virtuosic piece. Is this a coincidence? Are you just looking for really difficult pieces to do?
Well, I think that almost any concerto is really difficult once you get really perfectionistic about it. But I think that the Lalo is difficult in a very flashy sense. You know, a lot of fast note and virtuosic passages, and so it's quite effective. You know, it's not just hard, it actually looks hard, which for a lot of concertos, like the Brahms concerto is a prime example, which is really difficult, but the audience doesn't really notice it, you know. So that's something that's very gratifying about the Lalo, that even though it's a huge workout, you have to work so hard and it's very difficult, but it also looks very difficult. It's very, very effective. And it's a very beautiful piece with a lot of character. It's really, really quite wonderful, and it's not done very much nowadays, which is a pity. So I think if you go back 50, 60 years...
When it was debuted, it was much admired, right?
It was really popular even
Sarasate
50 years ago.
Debuted,
yes,
right?
Yes, Sarasate, he started playing it, and it entered the main repertoire, and it was until maybe the 1960s, 1970s. It was considered to be one of the sort of top five violin concertos, and everybody recorded it. All the old, you know, great old violinists have recordings of it, and they really approached it like, you know, like a real piece of music, with the kind of respect that you would bring if you were playing another one of the great concertos. And nowadays, it's a little bit become a piece that's played by students, that's not taken as seriously. So
why is that?
I think that maybe for a while, it was a bit overplayed. Audiences got tired of it. Also, the repertoire grew by additional pieces in, you know, all the modern concertos. So it sort of lost a little bit its place. And I don't know, it suddenly felt really out of fashion, but just in the last 20, 30 years.
Does that give you opportunities then? Because nobody's comparing it with the four recordings they have at home. You're bringing it to people in a very fresh way.
Well, I think that the violinists, it's funny, whenever I've played it with orchestras, usually orchestras haven't done it in a very long time, or at least not on a subscription concert, on a proper concert. But of course, all the violinists know it. And they will compare you not to your contemporary colleagues, but actually to Heifetz and Isaac Stern. So it's still a pretty tough comparison.
So it still comes with baggage, despite the fact
yes.
that it doesn't get played.
But
so
it's
often.
Incredibly effective, and usually, you know, the orchestra musicians are just delighted to do it, and audiences are suddenly reminded. I mean, many of them don't even know it anymore, but those who do are suddenly reminded what a good piece it can be, and that it's, you know, it's beautiful, it's charming, it's really. It's a wonderful piece of music. It's really written very much with Sarasate in mind, who is not just a great virtuoso, but a very charming player. Very, very elegant, very sweet, you know, he had a great tone. And
his personality came through the instrument.
Yes, he was a very...
effusive.
Yes, charmeur. So it's written very much for him. And even though it's Symphonie Espagnole, the title is a bit misleading because it's, you know, it's Spanish, but seen through the... or heard through the ears of a Frenchman, of course. Like a lot of the Spanish repertoire is actually French. It was written about the same year, around the time that Carmen was written.
That's right. Well, Spanish music was, or Spanish culture was very much in fashion in Paris at that time.
Yes, in vogue. And
I think there was only 2 weeks, actually, or 3 weeks between the debut of Carmen and this work's premiere. So they really
yes.
were on a Spanish trip in
yes.
Paris.
And then
the
it went on and on. Of course, all the French composers, they all had to write their Spanish piece, you know, and... You know, and some are more successful than others. But I think this is really, the Spanish motives are not cliché in this piece. You really just, he loves these idioms and he uses them, but he uses them very tastefully.
Right.
It's not kitschy the way that, I mean, unless you play it kitschy, I guess. But it's not a kitschy piece. The same way that Carmen is not.
No.
It's not tasteless. It's really tasteful.
But it's
yes.
recognizably Spanish
it's
as well.
It's recognizably
right.
Spanish.
When you're working on a piece like this, how are you finding the line? I mean, this stuff seems to flow through you. It doesn't matter what I hear you play. It seems to flow through you, and it seems to be of you. Is this because you have a natural gift for finding the line in a piece, or is it just a matter of a lot of practice?
Well, I think that most styles of music, the more music you play of that style, or by a certain composer, the easier then it is. The more you've absorbed that style, the easier it is to learn another piece, and it's a very familiar language.
So you almost, are you channeling then the composer's style, or is it? Do you have to have a sort of in your own head a relationship, a closer relationship with the composer to understand what they were going for, or is everything there on the page?
I think, with some composers, they really do write everything down, and the best thing to do is actually, there are some of the later French composers like Ravel, like that. The best idea is really to actually do exactly what they say. But I actually do think a lot about the different composers and the kind of approach to sound and to phrasing and to the harmonic tension and to the structure, these differences that are there between the composers and how differently you need to play them. And of course, you know, everybody has styles that they're better at than others. But growing up, I was so aware how a lot of violinists seem to play everything the same. So they just sounded the same whether they played Mozart or
they Lalo, branded right? themselves,
yes.
Right.
So I think that's a very important thing. And if you think about it a lot, you start to really figure out what makes Lalo sound like Lalo and Brahms sound like Brahms. I'll give you an example because it's very abstract. There's a lot of 3-2 in this piece,
right.
These polyrhythms. And you find that a lot in Brahms as well, but it's really completely different. Because when Brahms is 3-2, the 3 really pushes against through and you subdivide the 3. So you go da, 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 da. You feel sort of the 2 within the triplet.
Mm-hmm. And
in this piece, in the habanera rhythm, it's more da, 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 da. You really feel the triplet in 1, and it's not supposed to be even as much. You know, it's much more fluid. It's a completely different approach to this rhythm. So that's just one example. There's regarding rhythm and color and phrasing and, you know, a lot of composers, if you want to figure out the phrasing, you look a lot, you have to analyze first the harmony and where the points of tensions are, and that's the key. And with some composers, that's not actually how you find it. You still have to be aware of the harmony, but the phrasing doesn't really come from that as much.
Right, and how are you conveying that then? Because this is clearly not you doing a solo recital or doing a recital with an accompanist. This is a big monster called the Philadelphia Orchestra and a very well-known and very well-renowned conductor. How are you communicating your ideas back to them? Because sometimes you have a sense that there are soloists who are performing the work and the orchestra is there to support them. And at other times you feel there are soloists who are playing along with the orchestra. How do you convey your ideas to the orchestra and to the conductor so that there's no lack of understanding about what you feel the piece represents?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously you have your, already before rehearsal, you have a meeting with the conductor and you talk over it. But time is usually quite limited, you know. Hopefully you're playing with the conductor who sort of shares your approach somewhat or your feelings about the piece. And sometimes, you know, I find I actually adjust quite a bit to conductors and what they think, because if they have a very strong opinion about something, they often end up winning me over, because it's sometimes they've thought about it a lot and it turns out they're right. So it's important to be open with
that. That's very smart.
You know, other times I come away from a performance and I think, well, that was a bad idea, I won't do that again. You know, that happens also. But it's a collaboration, and so you try and the little bit of rehearsal time you have to sort of put it together. I think that the orchestra musician, especially for a great orchestra like this, like the Philadelphia Orchestra, they hear me do things and they understand and they react to it. You know, a lot of things you don't have to tell them. I noticed in the rehearsal, within the rehearsal, as we're just running through the piece, they figured it all out basically already. So that makes it a lot easier. With some orchestras that are not, you know, at this level, you have to then go back and really rehearse quite a lot and talk about things.
And explain it. I actually had a cup of coffee with one of the orchestra violinists yesterday morning, and she was looking at her music, and I said, you're going into rehearsal in half an hour. Are you going to sight read that? And she said, I'm not sight reading anything. I've been in this orchestra for 30 years. And I said, so what happens if, I was talking about you, happens if he doesn't want to play it the way you want to play it? We'll play it any way you like. We can turn on a dime, she said. So what you say is absolutely true from their point of view as well.
I was really impressed how responsive they were. You do something and they immediately react. And
are they, you talk about the conductor giving you ideas about what the piece is about. In the process of rehearsal, are you getting, is what the orchestra is doing with what you give them telling you more about the piece?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I'm somebody who I listen a lot to what I hear behind me. And it's different in different pieces. I mean, this concerto is supposed to be more, there is sort of an accompanying aspect to what the orchestra does in this piece. There's some concertos where that's less, it's more of a, it's almost chamber music like in Brahms. But I think in general, it's important that the soloist is also able to follow. And the best kind of ensemble, it's actually the same in chamber music as well, is that if you lead and other people follow you, then you also are actually also following them, following you. That it's sort of a, it's like a circle. And it's important to be able to do that. That's how you, I think, get really good ensembling in performance. And yeah, and I think it's just important really to listen what goes on below and around you as you play. And that's a very important inspiration. I mean, I was talking about knowing the harmonies and reacting to the harmonies. And, you know, it's really much easier if you're really listening. And then it's quite, many things are quite obvious what you're supposed to do with the phrasing if you're really aware. So,
well, yeah. As in life, as in music, if you listen very carefully, you're likely to be a lot better at what you're doing.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.